The opinions voiced in Wall Street to Main Street are offered for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, or financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing. Advisory services offered through Wealth Plan Partners. Securities offered through Securities America, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Wealth Plan Partners, Hamilton Wealth Management, and Securities America are separate entities. Wall Street to Main Street with Tom Hamilton.
Hey, good afternoon. Welcome to Wall Street to Main Street. I'm Tom Hamilton, of course, host of Wall Street to Main Street every Friday here on WYSL. My day job is president of Hamilton Wealth Management in Pittsburgh, New York. Hope your weekend is off to an absolutely great start. I got a lot of stuff to talk about on the show today. I'm going to lead off, though, excusing my voice, if I run out of voice today. Was at the Springsteen concert in Syracuse last night. Nancy and I went. And, you know, that's, I don't know if you haven't ever been to a Springsteen concert, but it's 3 hours. It's a lot of screaming and yelling. I'm not sure if I was screaming and yelling. I'm not much of a groupie type. But somehow I woke up today with very little voice. So I had a really good time. Now, I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. I can read your mind out there. I know the audience. I know we have a conservative audience by and large, and Springsteen isn't the favorite of the conservative thinking folks, right? And you're wondering, Tom, how could you do that? How could you go see a flaming liberal in concert? Well, I'll tell you how. My wife, Nancy, has put up with me in marriage for 32 years. I've dragged Nancy to hundreds or thousands of sporting events. I mean, drag sometimes. Sometimes it was something she would like. Like, we went to the Super Bowl when the Bills were in it, and their second Super Bowl, Orange Bowl, certainly locally all the time. So anyhow, Nancy liked Springsteen's concerts. I'd never been to one with her. So I went to the Springsteen concert, and I was very glad I went. You know, I will say she sort of dragged me to it. I think it was a Christmas present, the tickets, so I'm kind of obliged to go without ever being asked if I wanted to. But it's one hell of a show. And here's the kicker. Here's the kicker, and I'm going to make a point to this and then move it into the world, my world, or investing and stuff like that. I don't care what Bruce Springsteen's politics. I will say, if I sat there and he lectured at me for a big chunk of the show, I would, you know, that would have wrecked the entire night for me. Don't know if I'd have sat there and listened to him or not. But there was zero of that, just FYI. None. I have to say, so he's 70. I think he said he was 15 years old and 65, which makes him 74, I think. So he's in his mid-70s. Holy crap, that guy does a three-hour nonstop show. There's parts of it where they turn the lights down on the stage and it's just him. And I'm pretty sure the rest of the band and stuff is taking a break and going to the bathroom or whatever. But he never leaves the stage. And it is a hell of an impressive show. I'll grant him. And enjoyable show. No discussion of politics. He doesn't discuss much of anything. I don't know if he used to. So anyhow, it was a great time. I'm glad Nancy made me go. Right? Sometimes you got to, you know, even though you're dragged to something, you got to admit that it was enjoyable and a great thing to do. So anyhow, so that was last night. Then, of course, it was about 3.5 hours after the concert before we got home, which is the downside of going to an out-of-town concert like that. All right, so what was I thinking about with regards to that, you know, preparing for the radio show today? Well, let's start with this. When you're evaluating people in any walk of life, be it politics or, you know, investment management, whatever it is, or just somebody who has a platform like Springsteen or Elon Musk or Al Gore or whoever, evaluate what they do, not what they say, right? Evaluate what they do, not what they say, if you're going to pay any attention to them at all. Again, I don't care what some, other person says about who doesn't have expertise in a topic. Like if Bruce Springsteen was lecturing me about how to put, guitar notes and drum beat and lyrics together, if I cared about that, I might listen to him, right? You get beyond that, I don't care. Just like, I don't lecture people about their politics or their composing of songs. I'm an investment manager. That's what I do. I think I have some expertise in that. I think people have expertise in what they have expertise in. Outside of that, I just say watch what people do. So when you see, the classic example is all the lecturing on climate change, mostly done by people who flew there in private jets and have houses that, yours, mine, and everybody else's. Our houses would all together fit inside their house. Our carbon footprints all together doesn't equal theirs. So I pay no never mind to what those people have to say. Sometimes it irks me a little bit, right? Sometimes it irks me. But the same thing is true in the investing world. We've talked before about the ESG investing movement that seems to be fizzling out pretty quickly. But our environmental, social, and governance. I have to always think about what the three things mean. And I get a sneaky feeling the people raising a ton of money for those funds, they got to think about what the initials mean also. I think it's all just a marketing shtick for them. But my point is, watch what the people do, right? Not what they say in that case also. So a lot of times, What are a lot of these ESG funds? Well, if you look under the hood and you look at the actual investments inside them, they look a hell of a lot like an S&P 500 index fund or that type of fund. Like I remember I think it was the BlackRock ESG fund. I'm looking at the top holdings. Like ExxonMobil was one of their three top holdings. They probably aren't anymore, not because of ESG, but because there's been a lot of tech companies rise to the forefront as larger companies than Exxon, but I would guess they're still top 10 or 20. So what's the point of that? Why do they market it as ESG? Very simple, in my opinion. Again, this is a watch what they do, not what they say. So they talk about saving the planet and sustainability. Meanwhile, they have a very similar investment profile as other ETFs. And the fee that they're charging is a fair amount more, right? So now let's see. So what are they doing there? They're using something that they might be able to push over people's eyes to get a higher fee, right? So now am I going to listen to them and their opinions on saving the world? No. I mean, maybe I'd listen to their opinions on how to charge a higher fee for doing the same damn thing by calling it something different, right? That might be the cynical me talking, but I think it's pretty darn accurate. So, so when I get involved, we're a fiduciary investment manager, Hamilton Wealth Management. And I've said many, many times here on the show, I tell every potential or current client this, we don't let our politics influence our investments one way or the other, one way or the other. Case in point, we last year sometime, we've got some money invested in emerging market equity funds. And why do we do that? Because we think there's a lot of the emerging world, the developing world. A, there's a lot younger people in a lot of the developing world. Most of the developed markets are old. The people are old. It's hard to make things and grow an economy when all the people are getting old. It's hard to handle the burden of Social Security-type retirement programs when everybody's getting old. Europe, United States. So the emerging markets, we made a change, I don't know, a year ago, year and whatever, it doesn't matter. We switched one of our funds from a regular emerging markets ETF to what they call emerging markets ex-China. That means not including China. And you might look at that and say, oh, good, Tom, I'm glad you did that. I don't like the politics in China. I don't like this about China. I don't like the fact that they're a huge rival of the United States. And from a political and citizen standpoint, I agree with that. I agree with that. I am not, I'm sure you're not fans of China on the world stage. However, here's the reality. Being a fiduciary for other people's money and my own, that is not why we did it. We did it because the Chinese real estate market, you know, they overbuilt the market like nobody's business. They have huge cities with nobody living in them practically that they built for the future growth. The growth is slowing. The Chinese population is aging rapidly. They are going to have an extremely hard time continuing to be the top manufacturer of the world, other than they have a lot of people, right? They got their billion plus people, but they are not the manufacturing power. So, and they certainly won't be in the future, in my opinion, that they are today and have been for the past 20 years, primarily because their people are old. And that they went through that long period where they had one or no kids per family. So they have a very unbalanced society age-wise. The geopolitical pressure on companies to find other places to make stuff other than China is huge. It's irresponsible for companies to fully count on China for all their manufactured goods. Remember, everybody's shipping all manufacturing to China. Move it to China. Move it to China. Cheap in China. You can get it done in China. Except for the fact that it's a totalitarian government and they can pull the plug out from under you at any time. So, again, because of that, I thought that, and I still think this way, that we want less world exposure to China than the other emerging markets. And then there's a Taiwan thing, right? Right? If they have political instability vis-a-vis the world and Taiwan, God forbid a war with Taiwan or an invasion, wouldn't really be much of a war. That's another issue, that the Chinese market faced at the time and still does. So my point is, as a fiduciary, we felt that a better risk reward to avoid that part, avoid China in our emerging market exposure and in world equity exposure. But it wasn't political. And I'm hoping people can understand the difference, because if I ever thought the other way, we would just do a regular emerging markets fund. And again, if one of my clients said, "Hey, Tom, I just want nothing invested, no matter what, in China," we might accommodate that one client because they told me, right? They told me they want to avoid that. But I'm not going to tell my full, array of clients. I'm not dictating their politics and how they invest. So anyhow, the bottom line is, I always like to watch what people do, not what they say. I pay no attention to anybody lecturing or having an opinion on something outside their expertise. I don't get mad about it, right? I forget who wrote the Shut Up and Dribble. Was that Laura Ingraham? I think about pro athletes or Shut Up and Shoot Baskets or whatever. Everybody's entitled to an opinion. If you have a platform, have at it. I think the idiots are the ones who pay any attention to somebody with no expertise in a subject that pontificates about it and shames people on one side or the other of the issue, having very little knowledge on that issue. So, okay, that's the end of the first segment. We're going to come back. I'm going to talk about my most hated topic, which is taxes. I haven't just finished mine. It's even more hated than normal. So we're going to talk about taxes, taxation, and government spending when we come back here on Wall Street to Main Street.
Every time I think of you. Wall Street to Main Street with Tom Hamilton. Tax
man. All right, we're back here on Wall Street to Main Street, and we're here to talk about taxes. Yep, taxes. Taxes aren't my favorite thing, I'll tell you that. So I'm a small business owner, and as a small business owner, so some people know this, some people don't, taxes are a gigantic pain in the neck. And you can't help but feel like you pay just too much. Now, you may not be a small business owner, and you probably feel like you pay too much in taxes, income taxes also, and you're probably right about that. So one of the big differences is the Social Security and Medicare tax, right? So if you're a W-2 employee working for somebody, a portion of that, I think like 8.5% comes out of your pocket and your employer pays 8.5% that they put in that you don't really see into Social Security and the Medicare program. As a self-employed person, A, nothing gets deducted from your paycheck. You got to write a check or you know, send it online to the government. But B, you pay both halves of it. And although for 21 years as an independent financial advisor, as an independent business owner, I've done, you know, taxes as a business owner and had to deal with the Social Security thing, somehow it always surprises me. It's for the bad, by the way, that there's an extra 17% that I got to put in to cover the Social Security. Now, of course, I do quarterly payments and all the other stuff you're supposed to. But when you tally it all up, and my wife, Nancy, you know, she's a very good worker, does a great job. She makes a great living like I do. And when I look at how much taxes I seem to pay compared to what's taken out of her paycheck, I just scratch my head and say, what in the what here? Doesn't seem fair to the business owner person. But it is. I mean, it's just math, and the rules are the rules, and it all comes out. But what I think about every year at tax time, as I, you know, again, it's not just withholding like a lot of people. I actually see the money that I wrote the check for that came out of my account. And I've always believed that taxes should all be paid like that by everybody, right? It doesn't change the amount you'd pay. But man, having it withheld somehow is a heck of a lot easier than either writing the check or, you know, going into IRS.gov and watching them snatch it right out of your bank account. That's brutally painful, and you feel that tax money that you're paying, and it makes you think, huh, what am I paying this for? Is what I'm paying this for a good value? Then I hear, you know, the last couple of weeks, really the last couple of months, the arguing on Capitol Hill and the House specifically about funding this foreign war, that foreign war, Israel, Ukraine. I think there are four bills. I don't even know what the other two are. I don't even know what the heck else we're funding. And then I think about it, you know, that money is coming right out of those taxes I just complained about having to send in. And I don't seem to have any voice in this, right? I don't seem to have any voice in this. What's worse or equally bad is that most of that money isn't coming out of our taxes. It's worse. It's borrowing with interest that we have to pay as a country to fund other people's. And again, in the case of Ukraine, I'm not saying my opinion on whether the U.S. should be helping them with their war against Russia, but I think the reality is it's a fact that a bunch of money that goes over there winds up helping Ukrainian bureaucrats and government workers and insiders a lot more than it helps, you know, the men and women on the front lines fighting Russia. Let's be realistic about that. And I think that's in a lot of places, but maybe Ukraine more than others that we've been involved in helping, because, you know, they're known as an extremely corrupt government, a corrupt business environment over there. The two kind of merged together in an unholy alliance to facilitate each other. So, but that's a side. It's a sort of a side issue. Now, on to what's going on with government right now. And one of the things I've done for the last year or two, I just don't get caught up in this, you know, the wrangling in the House and the Senate and all that. I just can't afford to. I've got what I think is an important job. It's certainly important, maybe not to everybody, right? I'm not the president of the United States. I'm not, you know, I'm not Elon Musk running Tesla, right? But I do have 100-some families, couples, clients of ours that do depend on me and my firm to handle their finances, help them with their finances, and manage their investments. And to them, right, if it's their retirement money, their nest egg, whatever, to them, my job is pretty damn important. And I take it as such, right? Not self-important, but it's important to put as much effort into that as I can, as opposed to getting caught up in all this other stuff. But I did hear a little bit about the House is, you know, I think Speaker Johnson is in trouble with the Republicans because he's bringing these votes to the floor, like four different aid packages. A, I've always been a big fan of don't lump all this crap together, right? You got something to spend money on, put it to a vote. Not with this little carve out for this congressman and that carve out for that senator in this horse trading. No, here's the money. Here's it's going to Israel. It's going to Ukraine. Separate the bills, right? Ukraine and Israel have nothing to do with each other. Separate the bills and see what the people think and see what the government votes on. Now, how I would vote is immaterial, right? How I would vote is immaterial. But I do believe that we as citizens deserve our representative to have a voice and a vote. So if it does wind up that they vote on each of those bills separately, I think it should be a rarity, a huge rarity when we spend any money on anything outside of what we've already planned for in the budget, which, by the way, is more money than we have. So we're already spending more beyond our means. And then these things just get tacked on like willy-nilly. There's one here, one there, this supplemental, that supplemental. So I think it should be extremely rare to pass something like this. However, if congressmen, senators want to vote for it, that's what we elect them to do. And I believe we should all have our representative have a shot at voting and not let one party or the other determine what gets voted on. So, and probably a lot of people in the audience disagree with me because they don't want these things to pass, and they may pass with more Democrat votes than Republican votes. Okay, you know, that's the way it is. Vote for somebody else next time. If you don't like the way your person's voting in Congress, vote for somebody else. And that way, you know, everybody puts their cards on the table. We see what our congressperson and our senator, how they vote on these matters. And then come ballot box time, we get to decide accordingly. And if that decision doesn't go the way you like, tough, right? It doesn't go the way I like a lot of times. But you go back and you take another shot at it, and you talk about the issues, and then you vote on the issues. Okay, so that's the political aside on it. The spending and the taxes is, it's just galling to me, galling, that our baseline budget, our baseline expectation is like $2 or $3 trillion of unfunded spending every year, right? Getting to be more. Like we're getting to be, we're just the interest on our debt, interest on treasuries, which is how we fund our debt, is like the biggest line item in the whole budget. With rates higher and borrowing heavier than ever, that more and more is taking over the primary cost in spending. So you're borrowing to pay back your borrowing. Now, I think you and I, listeners, are more responsible than that with our own money. And I look at it, when I write my check to the government, that is my money. That is my money. So I will admit, I begrudge giving them that money. I pay exactly what I owe, right? I do taxes appropriately. I think you should too. I pay what I owe. But I begrudge giving them the money just because I know how irresponsible they are with other people's money. And these one-off spending bills are classic examples of it. If you and I have something happen, there's a big storm and, you know, half our roof blows off and we have to replace the roof, that money comes out of other things we had planned on spending. That could be the summer vacation, right, money. That could be the new car fund that you've been keeping. You don't get to just say, oh, that's a one-off. I'm not even going to count. I'm going to pay for that, but I'm not going to count that. That's not part of my budget, right? That's off budget. No. That's not how it works. So my belief is each of these spending bills that they're putting through for Israel and Ukraine and blah, there should be a subtraction bill that's required to go along with it that you have to take spending from somewhere else, not some cockamamie over the next 10, 15 years. No. This program that was funded in the budget is no longer funded because that money's, quote unquote, needed elsewhere. That way you have to make choices on where your money should be spent. And again, by and large, me, Tom Hamilton, I'm not a giant believer in much of any foreign aid. I would be perfectly okay if the government, the president, Chuck Schumer, I don't care, if they led a huge fundraiser for Ukraine or for Israel, and they could be the bully pulpit saying this is a very important cause, it's very important to the people, it's a humanitarian cause, whatever it is, here's where you go donate your money to support it, right? Not take my money. Those who support these things, support them, especially ones that don't really have any U.S. interest at heart, right? Where you have to really stretch and, you know, skew the lines a little bit to figure out what the real interest is here in the United States. But again, just finishing taxes here at the, you know, just finished them for April 15th. And each year that happens, I scratch my head and wonder, where the heck is all my money going? You're listening to Wall Street to Main Street with Tom Hamilton. Be right back.
You're listening to Wall Street to Main Street.
All right, we're back here on Wall Street to Main Street. Wow, third segment already. Hey, by the way, I'm taping this. So if any, I'm taping it Friday morning because I got stuff going on in the afternoon. So if anything happens during the day I don't mention, it's not my fault. Right? I got up bright and early to start recording at 8 o'clock on Friday morning. So anyhow, and also, by the way, thanks for tuning in to the show. I sometimes forget to thank the listeners. I know I got a lot of our clients that listen to the show and people that have an interest potentially in becoming clients of Hamilton Wealth Management, but also just a lot of folks that like to keep up on the Wall Street and the Main Street stuff that we talk about here on the show. So thanks, as always, for tuning in. And thanks to Bob D'Angelo for putting the show together. It's a little more work for him when I do the pre-recording, you know, for my convenience. So thanks to Bobby D back at WYSL Mission Control for producing the show. All right. So little talk about investing here. So the stock market recently has been, what's the word I want to use? Shaky? Shaky. That's a good word. Very reactive to any hint at interest rates not going down as quickly as, you know, they thought the Fed was going to drop them. Very reactive to really any geopolitical stuff. The S&P 500 index, the Dow, more down days than up of late, which again, there's nothing super unusual or exciting about that. It's just, you know, I've been doing this long enough, 27 years as a financial advisor, 21 of those as an independent advisor, you know, working for my own firm. And I just see this type of market. Again, if stocks were cheap, right, if the price to earnings were inexpensive, if growth of the economy was phenomenal, then this kind of market would smell and taste of opportunity for me. I'm not getting that feeling at all with this, not at all. And what I believe is happening, a lot of investors for years, this always happens when there's between big collapses of the market, right? The 2000 tech crash, the 2008 and 9 financial collapse, collapse when COVID started in 2020, 9/11, there was a big market drop and collapse. 1987, if you go back to some of the famous corrections. The Great Depression, if you go back further. The 70s, where markets went nowhere. But between those things, people get very complacent with investing. And you hear more and more people talk about how price and valuation that you pay for a company or an index, right? A group of companies, an index, whatever you want to, however you invest. Price doesn't matter. Valuation doesn't matter because over time it just goes up, right? Over time it just goes up. I believe that's complete nonsense, okay? Now, glad to debate anybody on this, by the way. Glad to debate, but I really don't need to debate anybody because I don't really care what anybody else thinks about it. I listen to all sides. I do a ton of investment type research and I've managed money for a long time. And you know, if somebody wants to invest a different way, if a different advisor wants to invest client money, hoping the market always just goes up, no matter where you start and what price you pay, and the price doesn't matter, they can invest that way. And any client who wants to put their money with that advisor or do it themselves that way, that's their money, right? Not up to me. I just tell people what we do and what we believe and how we invest. And if that's what they, you know, if that's a philosophy they prefer for their investments, then they're a good fit for Hamilton Wealth Management. If not, right, if they think all you got to do is buy the S&P 500 index when you retire and live off of that for the rest of your life, all right, well, we'll see how that turns out, right? We'll see how it turns out. But I think it matters when the valuations matter a lot with regards to future returns, where you buy and what price. The second thing that matters a lot, maybe more than anything in investing, is if you have good investments, can you stick with them during the bad times? Can you stick with them? And what allows me to stick with investments that we own at my firm, that, by the way, I own for clients and for myself and my family, my wife, my brothers, my mother, clients, whatever, right? What allows us, if there's a market decline, probably some of the stuff we own is going to take a drop. I think markets kind of, when markets move quickly, they move together. There's no, it's a baby with the bathwater, I guess is the best explanation. But eventually that sorts out and the cream rises back to the top. I'm mixing some metaphors here, but you know what I'm talking about. And when I'm putting a portfolio together, we're looking at investments that we believe, market be darned, on their own, they are good, solid investments. And we're paying a fair price for the revenues that that they generate or the income that they generate or whatever the reason we own them, right? We believe that they stand on their own as we bought them at a fair price for in the portfolios. At best, we bought them for what we believe to be more than a fair price, right? At a great discount or great valuation. And if something temporarily drops the price of those investments, but the underlying story of the investment doesn't change, which we keep good track of, then we're encouraged to either buy more or just hold on to what we have and stick with it, believing we know what we own and how the story is ultimately going to turn out or likely to turn out for that particular investment. Contrast that with the advisors or individuals that the way they invest is they've heard that the market always goes up. They can see a chart that the market always goes up. So they believe you just put your money in the market, all of it, just index it. Doesn't matter what time, you know, where the valuation is. Doesn't matter when you buy. None of that matters. Time always solves all problems. So that's what they're hoping for, right? To me, I'm an engineer. I have an engineering degree. Pretty good with math. Pretty good with calculations. I prefer to have the calculator, the pencil, the paper, the Excel spreadsheet, the reports, and I prefer to understand why I think investment A, B, C, D, E, you know, those that make up our portfolios, why we believe they will intrinsically be a good investment, not just because they're in this market that quote unquote always goes up over time. Now, our clientele tends to be close to retirement or into retirement, where they don't have the time, right? They're not investing anymore, or they're towards the end of where they're investing. Not investing, contributing to their accounts. They'll stay invested. But there's not a lot of new money coming in, right? It isn't like my kids, who I believe should invest primarily in long-term index funds, inexpensive funds, putting money in as you go. Because then when the market goes down over their lifetime, they're buying more shares for the dollar. When it goes up, they're buying less shares, dollar cost averaging. Perfectly okay with that over a 30-year, 35-year accumulation phase. That's totally different than when somebody's going to be drawing money, you know, 3%, 4%, 5% of their portfolio right now in retirement or in a few years in retirement. In which case, again, my philosophy is, I want to know what we own. I want to know why we own it, and I want to have confidence. Then, when everything's going up, we all have confidence. I want to have confidence the next time the market takes a big hit. And by the way, I was an advisor in 2000, right? I've been in the business since 95. So I was there in 2000 when it looked like the markets were going down and never coming back. Same in 2008. Same in, with COVID and a few other times over that period. So I've been through it, and I know what it feels like, especially to have the responsibility of other people's money. But you better believe in what you own. That's all I can say. And if your belief is only because you've heard or you've seen a chart or whatever that shows in the past that the market's always recovered and come back as a whole, well, all the power to you. If you know, to me, that is when they say with investments that past performance does not guarantee or indicate future results, that's true in my book. That's true. The past doesn't tell you the future, right? The past doesn't tell you the future. You can take lessons from the past. Excuse me. You can take lessons from the past to help inform you of the future. But I believe that you have to have thinking, calculations, and intuition as to, you know, here's this investment we own. Here's what could go right. Here's what could go wrong. Here's what we're watching for. Here's what will tell us that our thesis on owning it is playing out correctly. Here's what might tell us that it isn't, and we should move on, right? We should move on. But overall, I like to have, you know, if we have a diversified portfolio of 13 or 14 different investments, about what we have in our models right now, I like to have confidence that at least for most of them, if the price goes down, just the price, not their business model, not their income, not their revenue, not their earnings growth, but if the price goes down, that we'd be confident in either keeping them or buying more, and then when new clients come to the firm, investing new client money in that same investment until such time as it meets our valuation expectations, at which time we'd probably sell it or sell most of it. So it's a difference in opinion in portfolio management. We do it differently. Again, I do the same thing with my own money, with my family money, with client money. That is the philosophy of our firm. That's what I believe is the appropriate way for people close to and into retirement to invest a good portion of their money. And other people have other ideas. And again, I used to debate people online and LinkedIn and Facebook or whatever, or in person at conferences about this. I don't really do that much anymore because I don't really care what their opinion is. The way they want to invest is the way they want to invest, and they can attract the clients that want to go along for that ride, but it's just not that's not the ride we're on at our firm. And right now is the kind of market where I'm darn glad we invest how we do, because the shaky market, right, there's very shaky hands out there in the investing world. Markets like this can shake people up and shake them out. And what most people do, they sell at the worst time. Why? Because they don't believe in what they own. That's the bottom line. They don't really believe in it. They were just hoping, or someone told them it would go up or whatever. So anyhow, that's our, at Hamilton Wealth Management, that's our philosophy. I thought I'd pass that along for people that, you know, you don't have to invest with us. I don't tell people what to do with their money unless they're clients of ours, in which case we help them take care of things. You're listening to Wall Street to Main Street with Tom Hamilton. Be right back.
Wall Street to Main Street with Tom Hamilton.
We're back here on Wall Street to Main Street. Well, it's Friday, right? Can't complain about that. Hope you got a great weekend planned. I'll tell you the truth, I haven't even looked into what the weather is or anything like that for this weekend. So maybe after I finish the show, I'll start spending a few seconds figuring out what the heck we're doing this. Well, what are we doing this weekend? Nancy's out of town, so she's got a college reunion with a bunch of her friends from college. So So that's going on. I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what you're doing, but, you know, hopefully it's good weather. That's all I can say. All right. Wanted to talk about bonds a little bit. 2 years ago, year and a half, two, something like that. We talked quite a bit for a bunch of shows about I-bonds. I-bonds are treasury bonds, inflation-protected treasury bonds. Not to be confused with TIPS, which are a different type of inflation-protected treasury, by the way. But I-bonds, at the time, you could buy $10,000 per person at treasurydirect.gov or something like that. And when we were talking about them, the rates were like going up to 9.6%, I believe, on I-bonds for that six-month period, which was crazy high. Because again, they're tied to inflation and they're treasuries, so they're guaranteed, very safe investments, like any treasury. So we talked about them. Didn't recommend people do it or not do it. I always am very careful to only. We did with clients, right? Clients of ours we talked to and we went over the pros and cons and. Some of them invested in I-bonds, some of them did not invest in I-bonds. My wife Nancy and I did, $10,000 each. And, then the rate went down to like 6.8. And then, every 6 months it resets the rate. And they're a little bit complicated. If you hold them for 5 years, there's no penalty. If you sell them after 1 year, you got to give back 3 months of interest. But again, if you when you're getting that type of interest, that's back when interest rates were still lower for things like money markets and stuff like that. So why do I bring it up? I'm just reminding people that the rates have changed substantially. They're much lower now on I-bonds. And, I'm not telling you what to do because your goals and needs and risk tolerance isn't the same as mine. But we don't own ours anymore, right? And my wife and I don't own them. A bunch of clients don't own them. And some of the clients do still own them. So, there's no right or wrong answer on I-bonds. It's different strokes for different folks. They're more appropriate for some people than for others, depending on your needs and spending and stuff like that. We thought with the lower rate, we could find opportunity elsewhere, and we took the couple years or year and a half of high rates we got, happy with it, did very well on them, and we moved on to other stuff. And they're not hard to cash in. You buy them online at treasurydirect.gov, I think, and then you cash them in at the same place. The money just goes right back to your bank account. So that's I-bonds. Bond investing has been fraught with problems or troubles for people the last 2.5 years. Again, I don't want to say I told you so, but last week I read from my 2022, January 20 of 22, Market Outlook newsletter to the clients, and I commented on how I just don't like most bonds or bond funds right now. Rates were extraordinarily low, and bond funds do better when rates are going down. Well, when you're down to zero on rates, how much more do you have to go? That's how I looked at it. Certainly, I thought the next big move, I didn't know when or how, but the next big move had to be up from zero, and now we're at five or whatever on the Fed funds rate, but here's kind of what we're looking at in the bond market today. Like a lot of people at the beginning of this, so 2022, the aggregate bond fund investment went down like 20-some percent, 20. That's a lot for bonds. It was a horrible year. I think 23 was a bad year. 24, I think, is down just a little bit. 23 wasn't like 22, where people got killed in bonds. But they just didn't look attractive to us, and we still... Like, I personally don't think longer-term bonds are attractive today. Like, I don't want to lend money to the U.S. government for 30 years for 4.5%. I prefer to get – we were just buying some treasuries for client accounts. We got like 5.25 or something yield to maturity on six-month treasuries. I think you can get close to that in a year. Treasury, maybe a little. It's an inverted curve, so maybe it goes down a little bit from there. Now, the risk you're taking by doing six-month treasuries instead of longer term is if rates go way down, and when that treasury matures, you can only get 2%, right? You can only get 2% for a treasury 6 months from now. I don't know. I don't think that's happening. Money markets, we use a treasury money market more, but we use regular money markets and treasury. Again, treasury money markets just... have that added safety of the underlying investment, government money markets, whatever you want to call them, they're still over 5%, the ones we use. And I know you can get that at a lot of places. They're not FDIC insured. They're not Treasury. Well, I mean, Treasury money markets are Treasuries, the underlying investment. But money markets aren't the same guarantee. To me, they're extraordinarily safe. The government money markets are extraordinarily, extraordinarily safe for clients. We have no qualms about putting people's safest money into those types of investments. But what's the risk there, right? What's the risk? Well, you're not locking up any term. They're liquid at any time, right? Client puts some of their savings in. We have lots of clients doing this. They'll say, hey, I got $80,000 in the bank doing nothing. We'll either put it in treasuries or treasury money market on their behalf, you know, at our firm, Hamilton Wealth Management. And we tell them, anytime you need that money, the roof blows off or your daughter or granddaughter's or grandson's getting married and you want X amount of that money back, it's totally liquid. You can have it back in your bank account in 3 days from the investment account. And they typically have always traded at a flat price with interest, right? 1% or a $1 share price with, again, now today, around 5% annual interest. So some people are taking on more risk for, like, corporate bonds, right? And we own corporate bonds in a different way, right? But if you can get 5%, 5.2% on a six-month treasury, I personally have no interest at all in getting 5.5%, like 3/10 better on a corporate bond that while it might be pretty safe, could go belly up, right? And the longer you go out, the more risk you're taking. And sometimes it's great to take more risk on for the reward, right? Sometimes very appropriate to. But in my opinion, the bond market, you aren't getting much extra reward for taking on a small amount of risk for what they call investment grade bonds. We just don't own much of that at all in our portfolios. Maybe next to none of generic corporate bond type funds. We use other types of funds. We use loan funds. Won't get into the details of it. They are higher risk, obviously, than treasuries and money markets, and maybe even they're higher quote unquote risk than investment grade, high rated corporate bonds. But instead of paying 5-6%, we're getting like double that yield on them, right? So risk reward. We offset some of our stock portfolio exposure with those types of investments also, stock and bond portfolio. So we're controlling the overall risk of the portfolio. But my point is, and I always believe in this as an investment and investment manager, if you're going to take risk, you should be expecting or attempting much higher reward, right? More risk, expect more reward. Don't take more risk for just a tiny little bit of extra reward, that potential, that is. That I think that's the biggest mistake people make in investing is they spread over various risk parameters, but some of those risks they're taking, you know, they're taking the risk for 2 or 3 tenths potential return, right? With the downside being the whole thing craps out or it craps out pretty bad and you could lose a lot of money. For my money right now, you know, the truth is 5%, 5.2% in a six-month CD, that's not too darn bad, right? When was the last time you could get a guaranteed return, be it a CD? Same with CDs, by the way. CD, money market, treasury. When was the last time you could get that paid more than what inflation is, right? For a long time, inflation was high and interest rates on these types of things was 0 to 1 or 2%, right? 9% inflation, 1.5% on a money market. You're losing every day on that. You're losing purchasing power. Today, I think it's a pretty good deal for people. And is it an investment or is it just a holding place for money? It's kind of both. It can be part of both. So anyhow, that's the bond world. Just wanted to touch on it. Didn't want to get into great detail. Again, not recommending anything I just talked about for or against for anybody, right? That we only do that with people that are clients of our firm. And, you know, we know them. We know their situation. We know their needs. We know their financial, you know, how much money they have to invest, how much income they need in retirement or saving for retirement. And everybody's situation is very different. And recommendations are based on that situation. But I wanted to talk about it just in general here on the show because you know, growth investing, stock investing, equity investing is just more interesting and fun for a lot of people. But bonds, real estate, you know, commodities, the other things that make up a lot of the world markets, those are also very, very important, especially in certain times of investing. And again, we're involved in a lot of different parts of the market when we diversify at Hamilton Wealth Management. So anyhow, I guess we're done for the show. Boy, this one went quick. If you got any questions, want to get a hold of us, you know, we do have a lot of people that want to have appointments with us to review their situation. That first review we don't charge for because we don't know if we can help somebody or not. We like to get together with people. I like meeting people anyhow, especially listeners to the show. But we like meeting people. Talk about your situation confidentially. Then if we can help, we'll tell you how we think we can help. And if things work out, we could be, you know, you could be 20 years from now, you could be one of our 20-year/lifetime clients. Or if it doesn't make sense to work together, then that's fine too. But if you want to get a hold of us, it's HamiltonWealthManagement.com. My email is, I get a lot of emails, but Tom@HamiltonWealthManagement.com. Not too hard to remember. We got a phone number there on the website if you'd rather call, but HamiltonWealthManagement.com. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next Friday.
The opinions voiced in Wall Street to Main Street are offered for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, or financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing. Advisory services offered through Wealth Plan Partners. Securities offered through Securities America, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Wealth Plan Partners, Hamilton Wealth Management, and Securities America are separate entities.